disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, July 7th, 2018. In this episode, we feature three interviews. First, an interview with Dr. Bones, a gonzo journalist out of Florida, on the ongoing situation at the Stony Brook Apartments that he covered recently on It's Going Down. Next, we have an interview with two people from Occupy ICE LA, and finally, we talk to two comrades at Occupy ICE San Francisco. If you haven't heard already, charges against the remaining J20 defendants are completely and totally dropped. As Unicorn Riot wrote today in D.C. Superior Court, federal prosecutors filed notice on their intention to drop charges against all remaining defendants facing charges from protests against Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th, 2017. All defendants had originally faced felony charges of conspiracy to riot, engaging in riot, and several counts of property destruction, with each person facing a sentence of up to 60 years in prison. The last 39 defendants have now had their charges dismissed without prejudice, meaning the charges could hypothetically be refiled at a later date. This defeat of the state's witch hunt is a major victory for the anarchist and anti-authoritarian movement, representing our ability to support people over the long haul. Shows the importance of moving as a block within the legal system and refusing to allow the state to divide us, and also shows, as always, the importance of refusing to snitch and turn on each other despite some people facing upwards of 80 years in prison. Let's remember that many other rebels from other autonomous social movements are also facing serious charges, from Standing Rock to the Charlotte Uprising to Ferguson. Let us take the lessons learned from J20 and apply it to these upcoming and ongoing legal battles. Here's a rundown of updates from Occupy ICE encampments across the U.S. In Portland, a hunger strike has been called, and the encampment continues. In Tacoma, the encampment is down, but assemblies and noise demos are still taking place every day. In SF, the encampment continues to grow strong. However, at the time of this writing, police are attempting to evict the encampment, so time will tell. See our interview with two people from the occupation later in the show. In LA, the encampment continues to grow strong. See our interview with two organizers from the encampment later in the program. In Louisville, Kentucky, the encampment continues, but also faces the threat of harassment from far-right trolls. More people are encouraged to come out. In Charlotte, North Carolina, a similar situation is playing out. People are encouraged to come and bring items to share and bodies to fill the space. In Wichita, Kansas, actions continue outside of the ICE facility despite police repression. In Atlanta, Georgia, the encampment was evicted, sadly. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the occupation is now in front of the mayor's office. In New York, New York, police seem to have recently cleared out the camp as of this time, unclear as to what the next steps are. On this 4th of July, anti-fascists and anarchists across the U.S. and around the world mark the 20th anniversary of the passing of both Dan and Spit, two members of Anti-Racist Action, or ARA, who were savagely murdered in Las Vegas by neo-Nazi skinheads 20 years ago. Head over to the Torch Network for a full roundup, but here's a brief overview. In solidarity with Dan and Spit, Charlottesville comrades doxed the entire leadership of the upcoming Unite the Right rally. In Lexington, Kentucky, comrades published a remembrance of Dan and Spit. In Richmond, Virginia, Antifa Seven Hills handed out memorial flyers and sparklers to spread the word about Dan and Spit in their local community. Later that night, they unveiled a solidarity banner complete with fireworks to celebrate the Day of Action. In Portland, Oregon, anti-fascists in Portland honored Dan and Spit with an impressive banner drop and messages of solidarity around the city. In New York, New York, comrades from Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, in New York put up graffiti in solidarity with the call to action. In Sydney, Australia, comrades in Sydney brought the Day of Action down under with a powerful mural commemorating Dan and Spit. In Sacramento, California, Antifa Sacramento put up a banner in honor of Dan and Spit, and anti-racist activists lifted up the names while taking to the streets for an anti-4th of July party that included an action at the local ICE building and a noise demo at the county jail. In Seattle, Washington, comrades in Seattle showed up with an anti-fascist graffiti mural celebrating Dan and Spit. In Bloomington, Indiana, people organized a memorial dance party. In Atlanta, Georgia, anti-fascists put up posters honoring the memory of Dan and Spit. But those are all the actions that we know about. If we missed any, be sure to send them to us and also people in the Torch Network so they can compile them on their website. See our show notes for photos and tweets. Speaking of anti-fascism, according to leaked emails, Jason Kessler is largely telling his alt-right fail lords to plan to be in Washington, D.C. on August 12, 2018, as the main rally point for Unite the Right No. 2. Neo-Nazi plans for August 11th are not yet known, and a hearing later in July will decide if Kessler will be allowed to have a permit in Charlottesville, Virginia, if at all. Within the last several weeks, various neo-Nazis and alt-right pundits have attacked Kessler in blogs and podcasts, claiming that Unite the Right No. 2 will be a total failure, as was the first. Check our show notes for examples of the leaked emails that Kessler has been sending. And now, resistance and repression news. In Chicago on the 4th of July, people held a barbecue and gave away revolutionary literature at Marshall Square. Protesters at the Statue of Liberty climbed up to drop an Abolish ICE banner. In West Virginia, the IWW has some new counter-recruitment posters to put up in the face of several white nationalist groups organizing in the area. On July 1st, in Minneapolis, anti-colonial graffiti was written. An anti-ICE banner was dropped in Columbia. Also in Missouri, inmates at the Tipton Correctional Center caused property damage Wednesday night after a disturbance broke out. According to a Department of Corrections official, inmates damaged some windows and broke some shower divider walls in some of the housing units. The official said inmates were protesting new changes to rules in the housing units. They said no injuries were reported. In Gary, Indiana, quote, powerful action at the Gary Airport. They deport about 200 people from there every week. Flights leave Friday at 11:30. They drive detainees there in vans and load them in shackles into the planes. Today, they cancel the vans and the flight because of our action. Residents at the Kimball Tenants Union in Albany Park neighborhood of Chicago on rent strike. See our show notes for more info. In Westover, Maryland, guards are stating that problems located within the prisons locally are causing things to be on the verge of open revolt. One officer stated, because of that, is what an all-hands-on-deck situation to get everything under control as quickly and safely as possible. Chad said that he and other COs believe the inmates are beginning to take a stand against the conditions in the prison, and because of the amount of open guard positions. Chad said that it presents a very dangerous work environment for the COs. Also in Maryland, a group of Target workers staged a demonstration, quote, a small group of workers at the retailer Target Corporation is demanding accountability from local store managers in the Baltimore area, highlighting issues of discrimination and fair scheduling that would affect retail workers nationwide. That's going to do it for us right now. Please enjoy these upcoming interviews.
What's your plan for tomorrow? Are you a leader or will you follow? Are you a fighter or will you cower? It's our time to take back the power. What's your plan for tomorrow? Are you a leader or will you follow? Are you a fighter or will you cower? It's our time to take back the power. What you gonna do when they show up in black suits? Your street and our mid boots, and then silence you. What you gonna say when they strip your rights away and the tax man makes you pay for every bit of sweat you've been today? We don't need to run and hide. We won't be pushed off to the side. What's your plan for tomorrow? Are you a leader?
Okay, we're joining here today with Dr. Bones. Dr. Bones, just for anybody that doesn't know, if you want to give yourself a little introduction and maybe tell people about the guillotine and other projects.
Sure. I'm Dr. Bones. I'm an egoist communist, a gonzo reporter. My writings can be found at godsradicals.org, and I'm also the co-host of The Guillotine, a revolutionary news podcast that does not give a fuck and is bringing as many details of the horrible, horrible world that we live in to as many people as possible.
Okay, awesome. So you recently wrote an article in conjunction with some people on the ground about an apartment complex in Florida. Can you just lay it out? There was a call-in campaign that happened yesterday, just for people that maybe if they haven't had a chance to read it, kind of, first off, how did you get in contact with these people, but also what are the conditions for people that have been living there for a long time?
Sure. The people got the Palm Beach County Tenants Union, someone associated with that, got a hold of me. There was a GoFundMe that they wanted me to be aware of and that they was hoping that I could share on social media. Going through the GoFundMe, I realized that this is something that is truly, truly horrific. A group of tenants in the Stony Brook apartments, which are a Section 8 housing that has basically practically been abandoned by management, management being connected to the Cleveland Mafia, has basically just been scooping up all the rent and all the money from the local government and running away with it. They have been living in black mold-infested apartments. The children there are on nebulizers. Some of the doors have a habit of not opening, so people will be trapped inside and management won't send someone out to fix it until the next day. There's an infestation of roaches and everything there. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's inhuman living conditions, what it is. It's a prison. And the tenants have, in conjunction with some people that came out of the Palm Beach DSA and started this tenants union, they went in there, basically asked, how can we help? And the people inside Stony Brook have self-organized into this residence council. And the minute they started self-organizing, the management mysteriously had their cameras stop recording any kind of vandalism that was undertaken onto these people's property, onto their apartments, and onto their cars. So this is really legitimate, straight-up, realer-than-real class warfare. These people are being punished, they're being attacked, and they're being forced to live in inhuman conditions.
And there was something, too, like if they couldn't be outside, or they would get fined if they were outside, or it was...
Oh, yes. You are not allowed to stand outside of your apartment because it's a criminal danger. And some of these places, now, I went down there to investigate, and some of these places, you open the door and you can't breathe. The mold is that bad. I mean, I've been into plenty of abandoned buildings as a young kid. I have never experienced anything like this. And we're talking about children. One of the ladies said that she, you know, tried to stay out there, and she had a tiny, tiny little kid in diapers, you know, that was basically being forced to live in this. The people are inspected all the time. They aren't allowed to have welcome mats. The welcome mats get thrown away. They aren't allowed to have their laundry facility has been closed for about a year. They aren't allowed to hang their clothes to dry. One of the people there, Miss Lee, who I'll be writing an article about or mentioning, she tried to have someone evicted for daring to use her first name. So it is very much a straight up slave camp.
Right. And what are they getting out of this? They're just, how are they benefiting at all from these conditions, the people that are running this facility?
Oh, well, they're getting money from the state. The state, because it's Section 8, has to pay top dollar for the properties regardless of what they're in. So some of the people in these apartments are basically paying the equivalent of $1,000 for rent. Mm-hmm. And all that's going into a very, very murky deal. Millennia Housing is the management company for the past 2 years. And then Millennia will say, well, we can't do anything about it because it's up to the property owners. The property owners are associated with a very shady nonprofit that's also associated with a church ministry that was actually started by one of these asshole mobsters that, quote, found Jesus in jail. And proceeded to buy a whole shitload of properties. Very odd. So yeah, it's your classic criminal, like moving dollars around in a shaky, shady way. Everybody doesn't know. Oh, what, you know, a couple of years ago, the mayor of Riviera Beach, which is where this is at, told the residents, hey, this is the worst conditions I've ever seen. You need to stop paying rent. You need to do a rent strike. Well, apparently what that wonderful mayor didn't know is that there are very specific ways to go about that. The people, not knowing and not having any advocates, stopped paying rent. These people, the housing, basically took these people to court. And, of course, the wonderful, wonderful courts of Palm Beach County found all the tenants negligent and evicted them all. And most of these people have literally nowhere else to go. Stony Brook Apartments, you know, a lot of people say, well, why can't they move? Palm Beach County, which is the wealthiest county in the state of Florida, has a Section 8 voucher program. So they don't just give you money to pay your rent. You, if you're going to get any Section 8, you have to go to specific places. A lot of neighborhoods have not issued any vouchers in 2 years. So essentially, if you want help, you have to go to Stony Brook. And once you go in, it's very difficult to get out. And these people, so the people that need it the most were evicted en masse for withholding their rent in a, quote, non-legal channel.
Wow. Excuse me. You went out there yesterday. What did you see? And also, what was management's reaction? Because as you were saying on Twitter, that some news media picked up word of the story.
I'm sure what I saw was, frankly, disgusting. I mean, like, on the place looks, feels like a prison. You walk in and you can just, the place drips sadness and desperation. The front doors look like cell walls because there's no adornments. There's no welcome mats. Children are playing on playground equipment that's cobbled together out of scrap metal and scrap wood that has nails exposed that often gash their legs and arms wide open. We went into places and had to watch as children stood by as this lady pointed out a mattress that reeked of mold. Her apartment had flooded and gotten her mattress wet, and management refused to replace it. And they also refused to fix any of the leaks. You go through these apartments and you see that the management has literally been painting over mold, painting over water leaks, and it just keeps going. Light switches that have literal electric currents running through them have water dripping out of them. There's a whole bunch of hurricane damage that's still there. You have stairways that have are barely being held together. I mean, it looks like something out of northern Syria. There are sections of it that are supposed to be condemned, and these places are still being. And mind you, Marco Rubio said, asshole politician from Florida, you know, condemned this place as unlivable, whatever. And then he got a huge fat donation to his campaign war chest from Millennia Housing Company and immediately shut up about it. So, I mean, this it's unbelievable. So when we slipped in, we saw some a lot of things. I'm writing an article about that now for Gods and Radicals. A news, you know, because of the call-in campaign, and because the story about the call-in campaign went viral, local news media came down because they wanted to know about it. As soon as that happened, management called the police and told all the news media that they were going to be arrested if they didn't get off the property. And the police have worked with this management company for a while now. They have, the police, when they go in to Stony Brook apartments, they go in with guns drawn. And they, so to paint the picture for people, imagine a primarily black neighborhood that is having the cops roll up, put pistols in their faces, and tell them, you need to get back inside your apartment because you're not allowed to stand outside. That's the reality of Stony Brook. In fact, the neglect is so big that apparently a couple years ago there was a fire at Stony Brook. Children and other residents had to drag people out of a building that was on fire because it took the Palm Beach County firefighters an hour to get there. Meanwhile, Stony Brook is a mere 10, maybe 20 minutes away from Mar-a-Lago, the White House of the South that Donald Trump oh so loves to spend his time in.
Wow. So I think a lot of people are asking, what are the next steps? What happens now?
Well, I mean, one of the things about this being 100% horizontally organized and 100% coming from the tenants is ultimately that's up to them. If people want to keep abreast of this story, I highly advise that they follow the Palm Beach County Tenants Union on Twitter and Facebook, because they're going to be the ones getting updates. The lady that's really running it on the ground, her name is Crystal Lewis. She has had her car vandalized more and more times by, you know, what I assume to be management. She has not given up the fight. She has faced eviction. She has been threatened. She has had so many things come up against her. And she is an organized, she single-handedly has done so much to organize this community. I mean, pretty much when the Palm Beach County Tenants Union went in and asked, what can we do? It was Crystal Lewis that was there saying, this is what we need you to do. So this is 100% coming from the people. This is a 100%, you know, tenant organized, you know, on the ground, horizontal. Nobody's coming in to save these people. This is literally just an organic thing. And so the best thing is to basically watch the Palm Beach County Tenants Union and look for when they ask for help, because those discussions are happening on the ground with the tenants themselves.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we definitely encourage people to follow them and look for their next, you know, calls to action, but you know, it just shows you how screwed up. And I mean, obviously this is just one apartment out of many that has these problems. I mean, this is a problem that's happening across the United States. I mean, and also there's problems of water and, you know, all this stuff, and it's sick. And, you know, people are also making lots of money off of it, and also doing this in the knowledge that, you know, if you have a bunch of residents that are poor and largely African-American, you know, they're thinking, oh, they're not going to fight back. They're not going to raise any ruckus, or who would even listen to them if they did. So, but
oh, absolutely. Riviera Beach, that police department actually has cases on record of beating people to death in custody and being sued for wrongful death. So these people know that if they get in the hands of the police, that they have a very, very good chance of being beaten to death.
Yeah. Well, anything else you want to add on this story or anything else surrounding it?
I just want to say, I suppose, that Crystal Lewis is a fantastic organizer. You know, the people in Stony Brook are doing amazing work. The people in the Palm Beach County Tenants Union are doing amazing work. And, you know, I really hope that this becomes something more widespread. I think people should look into organizing around tenants unions, because there's some very interesting legal rights that a lot of people have that even some unions don't have, so right off the bat. And then also, just before I go, I would definitely add that most landlords, and when I say most, I'm speaking about 99.8% of them, probably deserve, I don't know, maybe like a gigantic lead bat forced through their skull at high velocity, spraying their brain matter upon the nearest wall as the people take back what was rightfully theirs in the first place.
Right, and there's just so much, you know, tenant organizing that's happening right now. I mean, just in Chicago, it was announced there's a rent strike happening. In L.A., there's several rent strikes that are going on. In Canada, there's several rent strikes that have kicked off. And there seems to just be an upswing of tenant organizing right now, which is, you know, great to see. I mean, we need it.
Oh, yeah. This is the front lines of the class war. These are the people that own your ability to stay safe in your house. If someone threatens your ability to stay out of the rain or take a shit in peace, you know, you're more likely to be compliant and not question the larger prevailing order.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Bones. And, you know, keep up with Dr. Bones on Twitter, and also check out Gods and Radicals. And you're on Patreon. Encourage people to support you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, good sir.
We're joined with two people from Occupy ICE in LA. They've been going now for almost 2 weeks. I mean, there's been so much going on there, and there hasn't really been a lot coming out about what's happening in LA. So can you all just introduce yourselves real quick?
Hi, I'm Paul.
I'm Derek.
So just take us back to the beginning, if you can. How did this all start?
Do you want to take this one?
So what I've just noticed was that I just saw people galvanizing around all these issues that were going on, you know, and the stuff that we've been seeing going on in terms of how people were being treated, how families were being separated, mass deportations here in L.A. And so one thing I noticed, that community started to get around it. And then there was just a call for a rally. Folks went out. And just from the rally, it just appeared to be something organic that just occurred, that just happened, and people just stayed. And people have just been sharing information, and that's what I've been seeing, what I've been observing. People have just been, you know, trying to spread awareness in the community of the things that are going on and what happens within that building. And so that's kind of how it went about, and that's kind of the trajectory that it's taking now.
Awesome. Do you feel like people were inspired by other cities, or this is something that just kind of happened organically?
So my seeing of things and the social media, word of mouth that's been going around, it just seems like it's very organic. Something that just occurred and went about. I think it's just the natural response of our human morals, and it's just saying this is wrong, you know, we have to speak up. And I think people are just galvanized by that and just wanting to take a stand. That's what I'm seeing from this end.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely put in some time there at the camp, and that's exactly what I'm seeing. Like, it's a bunch of different community members who are just like, we have to do something, and this kind of came around, like, organically. Like, it was the first night I was there, you know, it was all fun, but in the morning we had to have a meeting. It was just like, okay, well, who here has never done this before? Because I was definitely one of them. Like, I've never occupied a space before, so we really had to talk about logistics. We really had to talk about, like, okay, how long are we going to be here? Who's capable of doing what? Like, it's really been a community effort among various people to try and figure out, like, what is the safest way for us to throw some sand in the gears of ice.
Right. And I mean, for years, I mean, there's so much history of resistance in LA, obviously, but I remember last year there were like protests ended up blocking freeways after different ICE raids. Is there anything that's changed, or was this just, you know, kind of the same spark that kind of ignited the rest of the country that kind of pushed people to action? What would you say is different now?
I honestly don't think that there's anything different. This is just people are seeing the tide of authoritarianism rising, and they're saying, I have to do more. I have, you know, protesting once a month on a Sunday isn't really cutting it. So, like, how else can I, what other actions can I take?
Yeah, I would have to agree on that. I think that just the policies that are in place now isn't anything new. You know, these are things that have been going on for years and decades. You know, in history, just how people of color have been really, in some aspects, demonized. People that are in search of a better life have been denied that, essentially. And, you know, it's just that now that it's more in focus, you know, and people are like, man, this is really terrible. You know, and it's just galvanizing that strength to give people the courage to come forward. And I think that's what's just bringing a lot of people out here. And I think people come out with the hope that things are going to get better. But it's only going to get better that they come out here and do something. So I think that's why the community seems to be more engaging. The community has been supporting the encampment. You know, the encampment, the occupation has just been sustained by the community. You know, there's no funding. There's no nothing for this. You know, nobody's putting in money or things like that coming from any foundations or anything. It's just people coming by from the community saying, hey, what can we do? What can we offer you? You know, people that can't stay there, people that can't either, but they're like, hey, I need your supplies, man. Can we help you with anything? Can we bring you water, food? Like, what do you guys need, you know? And so that's just what we're seeing. It's just people from the community wanting to support it, and that's just what we're seeing.
Yeah, let's talk now about the actions that have been taking place. I mean, because, you know, to be clear, that people have been blockading the entrances and exits to the ICE facility, right? I mean, how much would you say is it shut down? Is it still active in some ways, or just does it depend on how many people are out there?
It is active in some ways. You know, like I mentioned before, we were trying to decide on the best and safest way possible. Our numbers fluctuate day to day based on, you know, who's available, but we always have a really strong presence there. So the actions that we may take one day to the next are slightly different. The main space where the encampment resides is kind of like a vigil space. You know, we're holding that in honor of the people being targeted, of the people who have already been deported, of the families who've been, you know, who have been devastated by years and years and years of, you know, targeted actions. And so we have not shut down the entire facility, but we have made things a little difficult for them, and sometimes that can be effective long term, and that's kind of the what we've all come to consensus on.
I think that some of the folks are there, and I think some people are just really adamant, you know, and so they're willing to do whatever, you know, and if they have to put maybe their personal lives on the line, their personal freedom on the line, you know, those are decisions that they're making because they feel that it's necessary. And so, you know, some of actions that people are taking, and we're seeing that throughout the United States in various, various different cities and various different states, you know, people are doing similar things because there's that like mind across the whole nation, you know, people are like, this is wrong. We have to stand up again, you know, and so that's, I think some folks it's a little more propelled because they have the capacity to do it, you know, and some people are just really taking the bull by their horns as much as possible.
Right.
And so some of the folks are just really trying to bring awareness, really, maybe not necessarily to halt just the building, but the halt of policies is their ambition, you know, to really stop this from occurring everywhere and not just here in L.A.
Well, let me ask you all, I mean, in some of these encampments, the police are trying to tell the people protesting outside, like, look, if you're out here, then people can't get in here for their bail hearings or certain things, or they can't. In some facilities, they're saying, like, if you're out here protesting, we're not going to let people visit their family members. So they're kind of like, you know, trying to scare people, obviously, away from protesting and also break up the encampments. But it's kind of like this carrot and the stick thing. I was curious if they've done that to you all, and also just, you know, based on the people that you see coming in and out of these facilities, like, what kind of feedback are you getting about what you're doing on the street?
As far as the local police are concerned, we haven't had any problems. Some other groups have used the opportunity to kind of go in and use direct actions with, like, civil disobedience. And whenever that happens, like, the LAPD comes in, but they haven't associated us together. They've been like, well, you guys are all coordinating, and, you know, they haven't tried to shut us down. So that's been really helpful. But we are trying to be mindful of that, because that is a true and valid statement that, like, some people do need to show up for their check-ins. Other people, you know, want to see their family members. So any actions that we have decided to take have been, like, a democratic process where we talk about the pros and cons. Like, if we do this action, who are we affecting? If we do this action, what's at risk? So, like, things have been very mindful in that regard. And I don't see that changing anytime soon, simply because, like, of how terrible, you know, nationwide, how terrible ICE is viewed right now. I don't think that it would be within the police's best interest to move on a couple protesters who are, like, demonstrating against them, because then that makes, you know, them look bad.
Yeah, I think that, you know, overall it makes, you know, if local law enforcement comes and intervenes, you know, it makes the public perception of it is going to be that local police is entangled with ICE, and therefore they work together hand in hand. And I think local law enforcement have that understanding, and so they're mindful of that as well. But for folks that are there, you know, as our brother was saying, you know, people are mindful that this is a space where people do need to enter, and so that's why actions don't occur to obstruct that entry. You know, they don't occur to stop people from doing what they need to do in terms of people from the public. You know, there are people here in the encampment that understand that, you know, folks are not in the encampment to benefit some people at the expense of others. You know, it's about everybody. Everybody needs to be included, and we need to find ways to take care of everybody and support everybody and to love on everybody, you know, and not pick and choose. And many of the policies that do, they say, we'll save you, but we're going to get rid of you. And, you know, the folks in the encampment are not coming through for that. You know, they're coming through for, we need to save everybody.
Right. And let's talk now. You all have done a lot of, you know, workshops and really kind of use the space to create, like, a hub for just political education and people coming together and learning. Can you just talk a little bit about that aspect of the encampment?
Yeah. Every week we're inviting speakers and guests from organizations, people with, like, political action experience, like, for them to enter our space and to give knowledge and to, you know, talk about their experiences, but then also to impart, you know, like, here's to be mindful of. Here's something, maybe something we haven't considered before. Had some people from who participated in Standing Rock share with us Black Lives Matter, share with us Undocumented Media. There are a couple different orgs who bring up their times in trying to share with us their experiences on how they're directly impacted by federal policy, or, you know, how their actions
I think some, you know, some of teachings, if we look at them as a whole in aggregate, you know, it really just exposes how many systems there are. But at the same time, it exposes the intersectionality of all these systems that, even though they may be geared to affecting one group, in the end, you know, it affects many. And there's a lot of repercussions behind, you know, policies and stuff like that. And so, you know, this is an opportunity that folks are taking to really bring awareness, you know, to let people know that these things really do happen. This is the reality, you know, whatever they're telling you in the public, whatever they're saying, this is what happens in reality. This is a practical outcome of it. And these are the results that we see. And so it helps to bring that collective knowledge together, because there's so much knowledge in the community, and, you know, that knowledge is so spread out. But through this whole time, you know, people have been coming together and sharing it together, and so now we have this whole collective encyclopedia, in a sense, you know, right here in this encampment, and so that's being shared out, and, you know, it's just going forward from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, just to sign off, where do you all want to see this Occupy ICE movement continue? It's, you know, it's going into 2 weeks now. You know, some places like yours are hunkering down. Others are getting attacked by the police and they're coming back. So I think there's a question now of like, okay, where does this go? Is this a long-term thing? You know, if everything gets evicted tomorrow, what's going to happen to it, this momentum? And also, too, just, you know, specifically for L.A., what do you see the immediate future as?
I was just going to say that from my end and what I see, I can't speak for everybody or everybody that comes through, you know. You know, so ultimately, the end is going to be whatever the end's going to turn out to be. But people, I believe, are in it in good faith, and, you know, and that it will continue on for however long it needs to continue on. You know, I think people are willing to come back if it gets shut down. I think people are willing to stand firm and just go about it. And even if it shuts down, though, and it actually just closes off, whatever time that may be, people are going to take the knowledge that they've learned and go out and use it. And so that's the practical use of it and the practical effect and the changes that it will make, because people now have that knowledge. And as the camp disperses, you know, or as people come through and pass through, you know, and they take that knowledge with them, it goes to wherever they go, you know. And so that really spreads the knowledge out, I guess, in a sense. And so where I see it going personally, you know, that's going to be up to the encampment. You know, it's going to be up to people that come through, people that go. Because the decisions are not made by one person. They're made by, you know, everybody there. Like Brother was saying, it's democratic. You know, it's not one thing. It's, you know, we're going to look at everything and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't have said any better. Like, day to day, week to week, you know, people can come and go as they please. Like, if they have something to contribute to the group, you know, we highly encourage that. Folks are gonna decide to be there however long they decide to be there. Like, nobody, no one person has any control over the camps. And if we do happen to, you know, get raided, or we do happen to get shut down, I have 100% faith that people would return in an even stronger force. So that's, you know, that's something that we're all kind of feeling, and we carry that with us every day.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add? Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Anything else you want to touch on or talk about?
So for me, a lot of folks, you know, the community has been really great with donations. You know, like, hey, what can we bring you? What can we provide? They can check the Twitter account. So there's LA Against ICE. We release what our needs might be every other day. There's also a Facebook account, LA Against ICE. But I would also encourage people, you know, if they're out at a march or if they're out at a demonstration, like, to meet up with people who also live in their neighborhood. That's what one big thing that's missing out of these large-scale demonstrations. Like, there's no element of organizing after, or while these people are there in mass out on the street. You know, how is it that, like, 700,000 people can flood the streets of Los Angeles, and then everybody goes home and things go back to business as usual? Like, that is a key opportunity to find your neighbors, to find people in your community, if you live in the Valley, or if you live on the West Side, or if you live in South LA, and and to meet up and to organize on a grassroots level, like what needs to be done in our communities and who do we need to talk to get those things done. I mean, it doesn't have to be centered around ICE. It could be centered around fixing potholes or getting community investment dollars. Like, everything from a tactical standpoint can be done with the people who live next door to you, and I would highly encourage people to start that process. There's a ton of literature online. There's a ton of people you can invite to speak, you know, much like we've done in this space, to just learn and gain more knowledge on how to do this occupation. But I would definitely plead with people, if you're feeling, you know, if you're feeling hopeless, if you're feeling scared, if you're feeling frustrated, link up with other people who share that feeling and harness the power of, you know, of a collective populace.
Yeah, very well spoken, very well spoken. I think, you know, the community has a lot of power, and the community just has to unlock that power, and, you know, people just have to get together, because there's so many people, you know, and throughout the U.S. we've seen it, unless it's that's something that we definitely want to see here. The only thing I would add is that, you know, there's a lot of sentiments coming from all sides towards us. A lot of people are saying, hey, you know, people should go do proper channels or whatever the case to get into the United States. And so I would just want to encourage the people that do have that sense or have that idea to please learn about that and see how difficult it is, and to understand how virtually impossible it is in most cases. And to look at the stories of people that have shared, the people that have tried and have been denied, people that have come with very, very heartfelt, heartbreaking stories and still get turned away. And so to really understand those things and the things that are going on now, and, you know, that's just a necessity of it. That's some of the education that we put out there to have folks know, like, what is the real struggle, you know? And so I know that people that are hearing this, I know that they know somebody that's in some type of situation, you know? They know somebody that's been in trouble, or they know somebody that's, you know, without status, or whatever the case, or somebody that's been separated because of the policies. You know, we just want to encourage everybody to go out and go learn their stories and know who they are for who they are, to understand their situation and the predicaments that they're in that brought them to the situation and facing the current struggles that they're facing today, and just understand what really are the true human costs of all the policies that are in place.
Awesome. Hey, thanks, y'all. Thanks for coming on, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're joined here today with two folks that are on the ground in San Francisco. They've been watching the events unfold at the encampment outside of the ICE facility. They've been out there. People have been out there for the last couple of days. Do you just want to introduce yourselves real quick?
Hey, how's it going?
Hi.
I don't have a name. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us. So let's just talk about, I mean, how has the encampment in San Francisco evolved? We've been talking to so many different people across the country that have been out there camping out. You know, a lot of people have said this has felt like Occupy. For you all watching this thing unfold, you know, not only in terms of infrastructure, but also politically, how have things developed on the ground over the past couple of days, as you would think?
I would say it's pretty reminiscent of Occupy in a lot of ways, maybe like especially in the sense of like, you know, maybe people who are involved in Occupy, being able to bring a lot of the knowledge that they developed during that time to this. And so, the camp has been able to like grow pretty rapidly and like, establish like pretty vital infrastructure, like really, really quickly. And I think in a way that like, you know, had a lot of people like not gone through that experience, you know, several years ago, probably would have turned out a lot differently.
Yeah, I think it's also been pretty clearly an effort on the part of a lot of different groups who all have interests in common in this particular struggle, but who come from a pretty wide range of political backgrounds, but at the same time, all have a pretty clear and radical view of the situation and what the goals are. And it's been nice to see that pretty smoothly maintained and facilitated.
Yeah.
How are you all how are people organizing things on the ground? Is it done through like assemblies? I mean, how do different tasks are you seeing people organize themselves basically?
Yeah, there are nightly assemblies, occasionally more throughout the day. Pretty informally, things are handled as they come up by the group, and then groups will form to handle specific logistical things. But it's actually been pretty smooth and easily responsive to things as they come up.
To echo that, like, definitely seems like while there have been assemblies, it doesn't really appear to be like trying to really turn itself into a managerial body. Although I imagine there are instances where that happens, but largely like people are like taking on tasks as they come. Like for example, like before the occupation was able to spread across the street, single lane traffic was still happening, and so like kind of I guess like independently or like I guess autonomously or whatever, people erected like a small wall out of pallets to sort of like keep people safe from the cars. I think at this point though, like the occupation takes up both sides of the street, and so there's no longer traffic that goes through.
Can you just describe that for people? So it's on both sides of a street. It's not just outside. It's not like on one side of the street outside of some building. It's taking over a whole area.
Yeah. So it's we were there yesterday kind of scoping things out a little bit. And at that point, like, it had taken up both sides of the street. In the beginning, it was just the sidewalk in front of the bus entrance to the ICE building. But the large barbecue sort of party that happened on Wednesday, the sort of anti-fourth thing, did a really good job at like spreading it across the street. So now it takes up basically the whole block. People are there like the streets are kind of blocked off, and the tents are slowly expanding. Definitely seems to be growing every day.
Sounds kind of like Aliens, the kind of the hive kind of spreads.
Yeah, exactly.
Outward.
Yeah.
Sure, there's not slime though.
So. Oh, yeah. Soon probably. No. it's pallets instead of slime, actually. Yeah. But yeah.
Did you want to add anything to that?
No, it's pretty much just from the barbecue. It very naturally sort of spread out to fill the space. That was also a day with a lot less street traffic, so it was easier to kind of move out then, and just didn't recede back after that point, and has just continued to grow and become more established.
You mentioned the barbecue. What is the role has events played in the space and bringing people in and giving the space, you know, a reason to exist in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, the barbecue especially was a big thing. It was just, it kind of created an atmosphere that was like, maybe, I don't want to say like intimidating, but maybe it was like less intimidating. It kind of made it feel like more of like an open space for people. It was like people of, you know, all age groups, from little children to older people. And it was also a cool way to kind of like, you know, make sure everyone got fed and had a good time. There's like, before that, there was like a karaoke event. So there's been a lot of like, in a surprising way, a lot of events that have just been like focused on like creating a sort of like, an inviting atmosphere. As far as I know, there's been no marches, for example, that have come out of the camp so far. It's mostly been like trying to create a space where people want to come and like be for as long as possible.
Yeah, there's been pretty consistent organizing of events, whether it's stuff like karaoke or the barbecue. They've also been doing workshops during the day, but just trying to keep consistent things happening so that folks have different ways to come and plug in. It's more inviting. It's also, it's in a part of the city that's maybe a little bit more out of the way for a lot of folks. It's right on the edge of the financial district, so it's not like a heavy foot traffic. It's not super near to public transportation, things like that. So it's another nice way to just keep folks moving into the space and giving them sort of a reason to come out if they're not happening to walk by, which is not as common in that part of the city. So it's been a really, really vital way to keep just mood up, numbers up, and have stuff for folks to do throughout the day.
Yeah, and just like it's just like, as an interesting aside or whatever, this kind of like at least to me, seems like a slight difference between like what's going on here in San Francisco and like what happened in Occupy, especially like in Oakland, where it like on the surface, it definitely feels the same and looks the same. And a lot of like, I guess like the quote unquote tactics are the same. However, like where I would say that Occupy was like largely spectacular. This is actually like, it's physically blocking the flows of, you know, like a political institution.
Right. And so, right.
Like it's interesting in that sense where like, maybe that's the reason why there aren't demos being called or marches planned, is because the point isn't to, I don't know, march around the city, but it's to like stop this thing from functioning. And so it's more about like bringing people in.
Right. And then on that note, I wanted to talk about, can you just discuss about that blockade? Like what has the encampment been able to do in terms of shutting down ICE? And also we've heard from numerous encampments that a lot of the times the ICE agents or DHS agents inside will kind of play this game with people, and they'll say like, you know, if, because you're here, you know, these people won't have a bail hearing or something like that, to try to get people to basically stop what they're doing and leave. And has that happened at all? And also, like, have you had any feedback from people that are forced to go to the ICE facility, and have they shared their thoughts about what's going on with you too?
I mean, as far as I know, like, the ICE facility is shut down. Mm-hmm. Like, there are no workers going in and out. And I personally haven't heard of any reports of, you know, like ICE agents like kind of retaliating against people, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, there have been, this came up also for the folks who are at Richmond detention yeah. facility, but there have been rumors. There was actually a young person who came up and said that their I believe it was their father was had their his hearing delayed.
Oh, shit. I take back everything I said.
But at the same time, recognizing like this is something that is not it's not a real result of the occupation, by which I mean that it's not that the occupation itself is actually the cause. It's something that is being instrumentalized by ICE yeah. and is being like used as a tactic. So while they were sharing this experience and concern, they were also very clear that they were like, this is not something I'm seeing, like, this isn't your fault, so to speak. This is something that the cops are using to try and basically pressure people. So there are those things happening. There are also lots of rumors going around that aren't necessarily substantiated or as easy to substantiate, but the feeling has really been that these are tactics to try and get the occupation to stop. And by stopping the occupation, you know, nothing actually changes. By letting go that ground immediately doesn't actually serve anyone in the long run. And so there does seem to be, while these things are like being said and these rumors are happening, and it does seem that in some instances there are impacts, there hasn't been a feeling that it's something that means that the occupation needs to stop. It's actually an indication to folks that there is something being achieved by doing this, and that there is some pressure being felt by them. They see there is real potential for this occupation or this movement really to interrupt and stop this this state apparatus. And so really that seems to be the feeling here, although it's obviously there are a lot of emotional aspects involved in this, and there will continue to be rumors. I'm sure there will also continue to be other things that we hear from folks as time progresses, but at least right now the feeling is that this is the best way forward, the yeah. only way forward.
Right. Yeah. And I think we can expect for more retaliation from ICE and like other similar institutions that will just, like, you know, people at the encampment and like other places will just kind of need to think about and like figure out how to approach them like intelligently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask, there was a report from Philadelphia that was put up today that was very critical of different elements within the Occupy ICE encampment that were, I guess, to put it in a very easy way to say, very quick to talk to the police. And I'm curious, how you all have dealt with the police, and if they have even, you know, attempted to engage with you all, or are they more hands off, and, you know, how do you all work that out?
They've been pretty hands off. There's actually been pretty low police presence up until now. I mean, and including now, but hasn't been a huge presence. There's a pretty consistent, usually it's set of two. Sometimes they'll come through. They've been checking things out a little bit from afar. But there, this was one of the original sort of decisions of the first assembly that happened at the occupation. One of the primary sort of guidelines is of the space in the camp is that there is no cooperation whatsoever with any state agents. So that as the camp, that is the position, that is the policy being sort of upheld by everyone. There have been instances of people who are just walking or going for a jog by who will come and sort of ask questions of the camp, you know, like these kinds of passersby who will ask both folks in the camp and will then talk to the cops sort of to get a feel for what's going on. There's also an attempt on parts of occupants in the camp and folks at the camp to convey to people that that is not something that's acceptable. Yeah, so that's been pretty much the hard line with few exceptions, is that that was a decision made by the assembly, and that's the rule for the camp.
Yeah.
Awesome. You know, one thing people have mentioned, I think out of Atlanta, there was a really good report that came out, and they were saying that there seems to be no kind of set decision within the state yet how to deal with, you know, these various encampments. It seems like each kind of city is trying to figure out, you know, in some cases they're very hands-off. In other cases, they've been pretty brutal. I'm just kind of curious, as you see it, how do you think the state will continue to interact with these various occupations? What do you see happening in the next few days and weeks in terms of, you know, the state's response?
I mean, I think it's definitely hard to tell. I think, you know, there's like a big anti-fascist rally that's planned for tomorrow. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in regards to the camp and the camps.
Sorry, pro-fascist.
There's also an anti-fascist counter rally. Yeah. Yeah. So there's an anti-fascist counter rally to a fascist rally.
Yeah. Sorry.
Just for clarification. Sorry.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and like what the sort of relationship between the camp will be. I think it definitely seems to me that, you know, SFPD will probably continue to be pretty hands off, considering the fact that, like I had said previously, that there have been no marches or demos called from the camp. And I think I don't want to like speculate too much, but it's either like they're hoping the camp will fizzle out due to like either lack of interest or internal divisions, or you know they're just trying to avoid like bad optics, given the fact that like San Francisco is like likes to view itself as like a pretty liberal city, and, or maybe they're just waiting for a situation to kind of like create like the good protest or bad protest or divide and kind of pit people against each other.
Yeah.
But it's honestly it's hard to see where that's going to go right now. Tomorrow will definitely be pretty like a sort of like a linchpin or whatever. It'll be really interesting to see what happens after tomorrow.
Yeah, I think tomorrow will be the first real test of how those dynamics play out and how the state chooses to intervene.
Do you all see this the Occupy ICE movement? Do you see it as having like generalized as far as it can go, or do you feel, because I hate to say this, but a lot of people were looking back at Occupy and noticing that like after people got the shit beat out of them on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, you know, then it kind of like really went viral. And it seems like that very much so that these encampments could grow, you know, exponentially. Do you still feel like that there's a possibility that that could happen, or I'm just curious your thoughts on like basically the potential for this kind of model right now?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential. I mean, just like the general historical moment that we're in, I would say is like probably the closest that, you know, like our generation or maybe even like the last generation has been to like a revolutionary moment or something like this. just with the way that like everything's been polarized and like, you know, quote unquote, like extremist like political groups have like been organizing very rapidly. And I do think that these will continue. And I think that, like just like the slogan "Abolish ICE" has become like a pretty generalized thing, and I think there's a lot of space for that to actually be defined in a way that doesn't just like energize the Democratic base, but really like takes into question like just the borders and like, you know, capitalism in general, and like it's sort of like the role that that plays in like uprooting like huge numbers of people. I also think that like if people, you know, if we're able to approach this, and I mean we in like the most general sense, if we're able to approach this strategically and intelligently, like, you know, maybe the occupation like form or whatever will reach its limit soon, but that doesn't mean that it can't take the form of something else. For example, like, I mean, flying pickets were like a big thing in Occupy that I think were really powerful, and I think something like that could be taken up either in tandem with occupations or sort of in lieu of occupations. I just think in general, like, this is like points to like a large political crisis of like, I guess like the nation state or something, and like what it means to be a citizen. And I think there's a lot of potential for a lot of stuff to happen, you know, if we can position ourselves properly for that.
Yeah. I think there's also a lot of potential in terms of linking this with other struggles that are happening concurrently, in terms of there's already been discussion of linking this with the prisoner strike and abolish prisons movement, as well as an understanding that these things like borders also serve a very similar function to things like pipelines and these large critical infrastructure, which are other ways of both dividing land and driving people off of land. And I think that there's a lot of potential in terms of really linking those things. But yeah, I agree that the occupation form may reach its limit. But I think as long as the movement is able to keep momentum and not allow the sort of abolish ICE as a reference to a return to INS become the driving line, but find a way to really link that with larger struggles and keep that from being something that's just, you know, eaten up and then taken apart by the Dems.
Yeah. I think like
the Dems. I love that.
Yeah. I think also like we like to kind of continue on what we were both saying, like I guess like, you know, we have an opportunity to like I said, like really define what abolish ICE means. And I think like it could be really interesting to like try and like recenter what the problem is. Like I see a lot of people like they say like looking at immigration as the problem, as if like it's people that are coming across the border as the problem. And like, this is taken up, you know, across the political spectrum from like the far right to the far left. And to me, this is really a question of like from the perspective of like the state or like people who want to govern. And I think that we would like revolutionaries or whatever would do themselves a great disservice to like remain within that debate. And I think like we can, you know, it would be smart to like recenter the problem, not on immigration, but on the forces that are actually uprooting people. And like, you know, like the state is actually the problem, or like the economy is actually the problem. It's not people that are like moving to like flee gang violence that is like fueled by like the war on drugs, or like, you know, the lack of like economic resources or whatever that are like being pumped out and flooded into like Western countries or whatever. And I think there's the potential for that. And I think it'd be really wise on our part to do that.
Awesome. Well, is there anything else you want to add? Any other things that you would want to say or impart to any other people and any other encampments that are listening to this? Or I think the other only other question that I have is for those of us that are not in the encampments, how can we support and engage in a certain way, even if we can't be there? And I think in like a very real important way, not just, I mean, of course, we need to send money and, you know, retweet stuff and all that crap. But I mean, what would be a good way for people outside, even if they can't be there and camp there, to really take part in this?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, definitely like the money and the retweets are very crucial. but I would also say it's like, you know, like it's finding I mean, for example, like there's a lot of smaller towns that have like Greyhound stations, and like Greyhound has been really they've collaborated with ICE pretty heavy, and they've allowed ICE agents to come into buses and like check people's IDs and stuff. And so like, for example, like people could either just do like something really simple, like flyering around like Greyhound stations, or like trying to organize like small pickets or something. You know, like there are definitely like, even if you, if there aren't ICE like facilities where you live, or there's not like a, you know, the environment isn't really right to do something as radical as an occupation, like something smaller is definitely very helpful. Even, yeah, or just like reaching out to like, and like find, trying to like make inroads with like immigrant communities, and like figuring out like how to like, you know, provide services that they may no longer have access to, food and healthcare and these kinds of things, I think would go a long way. We do have a statement that was written by some people from the San Francisco occupation that we'd like to read. And we'd also like to give mad shouts out to Atlanta, LA, Portland, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Bloomington, Tacoma, all the places that are throwing down super hard and taking the heat real hard and still not giving up.
Yeah. And one other thing I just want to add before we read this too, is that I think one thing you can do is, even if you're not physically near a space or can't physically be in an occupation or a blockade, is finding ways to really link this narrative and this movement with these larger things, finding ways to put that out there, and finding ways to really like build that framework to talk about it and to push this into something else is stuff that you don't necessarily need to be on the ground to do. But that type of work is also really important in terms of just like building a narrative that is more legible to folks who aren't necessarily already thinking in that space.
Yeah. All right. So I'll read the statement real quick.
Okay.
All right. What do we mean when we say abolish ICE? We demand and work to ensure no more concentration camps, no more family separations, no more deportations, no more racist killings. We do not mean preserve these horrors and give them a new acronym. We do not mean give us something like the good old days of the INS. We do not mean deny human beings dignified life because of their place of birth, culture, or the color of their skin.
This is not an effort to swing the midterms, nor will we let our blood, sweat, and tears on behalf of our fellow people be used to such ends. We place our bodies on the line to realize a world where a family can lie and love one another in boundless joy, free from domination. We reject the duplicitous efforts of Democrats and their pathetic claims to pin their own horrific policies towards immigrants upon the regimes of Bush and Trump. Both the Democrats and the Republicans care more to preserve current power structures than enrich people's lives. We refuse to live inside of their frame. Instead, we fight for a life worth living and are actively building a world without borders in which we can find meaning together. A world whose foundations are built upon care for another, an ever-growing capacity of self-determination, and to defeat those that wish to exploit and control us. We are inspired at every moment by the strength of all those that brave the deserts of this world to build this life with love and vengeance.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks so much, y'all. You know, encourage people to check out. There's two Twitter accounts. I don't know if you want to tell us those real quick. And, you know, check out the hashtag and just continue to follow the struggle and watch the social media feeds. We'll definitely be RTing what we can. But cool. watch the social media feeds, and there's a lot of events coming out of the encampment. And if you have a chance, if you're in the Bay Area, you're passing through, definitely come down and check it out and bring some supplies with you.
Yeah, if you're on Twitter, check out All Out Bay and Occupy SF ICE. They're covering a lot of stuff that's happening right now on the ground. There are also a lot of, like, you can just check out, like, Occupy ICE hashtags, Surround ICE, Melt ICE. And then there are multiple all outs for various cities that are attempting to shut this shit down.
Awesome.
And so the handle Occupy SF ICE, I believe, was just switched to Occupy ICE SF to fit the hashtag.
Okay. Yeah.
So either, if you search those, it'll come.
Find one of them.
Yeah.
Occupy SF Vanilla ICE is also another one for just.
Yes.
thanks so much. Do you want to talk about tomorrow or no?
Yeah, there's a rally called for 12 noon. Come on down. at the street address is 444 Washington Street, San Francisco. It's at the occupation. The hope is to have a bunch of people hang out. I think there will be been doing DJs and music and food and all sorts of fun stuff. But yeah, just to have the numbers, have enough support just in case any unfriendly elements decide to wander by.
Awesome. Hey, stay safe. Best of luck to y'all.
Great. Thanks. Thank you.
You too.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.